Part 2, Either Or. Chapter 1, The Man Who Belonged on Earth. Dr. Robert Stadler paced his office, wishing he would not feel the cold. Spring had been late in coming. Beyond the window, the dead gray of the hills looked like the smeared transition from the soiled white of the sky to the leaden black of the river. Once in a while, a distant patch of hillside flared into a silver yellow that was almost green, then vanished. The clouds kept cracking for the width of a single sun ray, then oozing closed again. It was not cold in the office, thought Dr. Stadler. It was that view that froze the place. It was not cold today. The chill was in his bones, he thought. The stored accumulation of the winter months, when he had had to be distracted from his work by an awareness of such a matter as inadequate heating, and people had talked about conserving fuel. It was preposterous, he thought. This growing intrusion of the accidents of nature into the affairs of men. It had never mattered before, if a winter happened to be unusually severe. If a flood washed out a section of railroad track, one did not spend 2 weeks eating canned vegetables. If an electric storm struck some power station, an establishment such as the State Science Institute was not left without electricity for 5 days. 5 days of stillness this winter, he thought, with the great laboratory motors stopped and irretrievable hours wiped out, when his staff had been working on problems that involved the heart of the universe. He turned angrily away from the window, but stopped and turned back to it again. He did not want to see the book that lay on his desk. He wished Dr. Ferris would come. He glanced at his watch. Dr. Ferris was late, an astonishing matter. Late for an appointment with him. Dr. Floyd Ferris, the valet of science, who had always faced him in a manner that suggested an apology for having but one hat to take off. This was outrageous weather for the month of May, he thought, looking down at the river. It was certainly the weather that made him feel as he did, not the book. He had placed the book in plain view on his desk when he had noted that his reluctance to see it was more than mere revulsion. That it contained the element of an emotion never to be admitted. He told himself that he had risen from his desk, not because the book lay there, but merely because he had wanted to move, feeling cold. He paced the room, trapped between the desk and the window. He would throw that book in the ash can where it belonged, he thought, just as soon as he had spoken to Dr. Ferris. He watched the patch of green and sunlight on the distant hill. The promise of spring, in a world that looked as if no grass or bud would ever function again. He smiled eagerly, and when the patch vanished, he felt a stab of humiliation, at his own eagerness, at the desperate way he had wanted to hold it. It reminded him of that interview with the eminent novelist last winter. The novelist had come from Europe to write an article about him, and he, who had once despised interviews, had talked eagerly, lengthily, too lengthily. Seeing a promise of intelligence in the novelist's face, feeling a causeless, desperate need to be understood. The article had come out as a collection of sentences that gave him exorbitant praise and garbled every thought he had expressed. Closing the magazine, he had felt what he was feeling now at the desertion of a sunray. All right, he thought, turning away from the window. He would concede that attacks of loneliness had begun to strike him at times. But it was a loneliness to which he was entitled. It was hunger for the response of some living, thinking mind. He was so tired of all those people, he thought in contemptuous bitterness. He dealt with cosmic rays, while they were unable to deal with an electric storm. He felt the sudden contraction of his mouth, like a slap denying him the right to pursue this course of thought. He was looking at the book on his desk. Its glossy jacket was glaring and new. It had been published 2 weeks ago. But I had nothing to do with it, he screamed to himself. The scream seemed wasted on a merciless silence. Nothing answered it, no echo of forgiveness. The title on the book's jacket was, Why Do You Think You Think? There was no sound in that courtroom silence within him, no pity, no voice of defense. Nothing but the paragraphs which his great memory had reprinted on his brain. Thought is a primitive superstition. Reason is an irrational idea. The childish notion that we are able to think has been mankind's costliest error. What you think is an illusion created by your glands, your emotions, and in the last analysis by the content of your stomach. That gray matter you're so proud of is like a mirror in an amusement park, which transmits to you nothing but distorted signals from a reality forever beyond your grasp. The more certain you feel of your rational conclusions, the more certain you are to be wrong. Your brain being an instrument of distortion, the more active the brain, the greater the distortion. The giants of the intellect, whom you admire so much, once taught you that the earth was flat and that the atom was the smallest particle of matter. The entire history of science is a progression of exploded fallacies, not of achievements. The more we know, the more we learn that we know nothing. Only the crassest ignoramus can still hold to the old-fashioned notion that seeing is believing. That which you see is the first thing to disbelieve. A scientist knows that a stone is not a stone at all. It is, in fact, identical with the feather pillow. Both are only a cloud formation of the same invisible whirling particles. But you say you can't use a stone for a pillow? Well, that merely proves your helplessness in the face of actual reality. The latest scientific discoveries, such as the tremendous achievements of Dr. Robert Stadler, have demonstrated conclusively that our reason is incapable of dealing with the nature of the universe. These discoveries have led scientists to contradictions which are impossible according to the human mind, but which exist in reality nonetheless. If you have not yet heard it, my dear old-fashioned friends, it has now been proved that the rational is the insane. Do not expect consistency. Everything is a contradiction of everything else. Nothing exists but contradictions. Do not look for common sense. To demand sense is the hallmark of nonsense. Nature does not make sense. Nothing makes sense. The only crusaders for sense are the studious type of adolescent old maid who can't find a boyfriend, and the old-fashioned shopkeeper who thinks that the universe is as simple as his neat little inventory and beloved cash register. Let us break the chains of the prejudice called logic. Are we going to be stopped by a syllogism? So you think you're sure of your opinions? You cannot be sure of anything. Are you going to endanger the harmony of your community, your fellowship with your neighbors, your standing, reputation, good name, and financial security, for the sake of an illusion? For the sake of the mirage of thinking that you think? Are you going to run risks and court disasters, at a precarious time like ours, by opposing the existing social order in the name of those imaginary notions of yours which you call your convictions? You say that you're sure you're right? Nobody is right, or ever can be. You feel that the world around you is wrong? You have no means to know it. Everything is wrong in human eyes, so why fight it? Don't argue. Accept. Adjust yourself. Obey.